Hey guys, well, welcome to another episode of ABV, and we're here with Matt Kirkegaard. Now, he's a beer writer for Brews News. He's got Beer Matt. You've got a ton of things going on. You've written a ton of words. I've got to be careful. I think I said this to you, that you don't turn the interview around on me and start interviewing me by mistake.
Oh, Matt, I was thinking the same thing, not because...
force of habit, right?
I'm very uncomfortable being on this side of the desk. So, so hopefully I do okay.
Yeah, you know, mate, I'm sure you'll be fine. I'm really looking forward to it. I normally hear your voice in my car while I'm driving along listening to the podcast. And to sit here in person and have a beer, it's been a while since we've caught up and had a beer. We were at BrewCon not long ago. I think we waved and said hey and didn't get to catch up because it was so busy. Do you find that with a lot of events and that you just don't get time and everyone sort of wants to chat to you?
Yeah, and it's actually a thing of that causes me great anxiety, you know, that actually amplifies that, because quite often at events like BrewCon, I was on one of the stages. Yep. And I was sort of checking the guests for the next time, and just because I've been around for a long time, a lot of people know, you know, I know a lot of people, yep, know me, and so whenever you're going to look for a guest, you go past a lot of people that you know, and you feel like you're
and
constantly...
you can't be held up, and you go...
Yeah, and you feel like you're constantly brushing people off, and you're a little bit focused, and then you also have conversations, and you never feel like you ever finish a conversation,
yep.
So... that leaves me constantly feeling that I'm being rude to somebody. And then also I'm 100% deaf in one ear. So if anyone comes up on this side, I often don't hear them in a crowded room.
And
I said g'day and he completely ignored me. So it can be a little bit tough at times.
Yeah. Is that what excites you though about the industry as well? That there are so many people that are willing to chat and to keen to talk around and get around at these things, like that are mates, like, because there's a lot of people that are mates.
Oh, but look, it is, and it's, I mean, funnily enough, that's not actually the thing that excites me about the industry. That is probably a function or like a result of why I love beer, because beer brings people together. And the brewing industry has always attracted people, you know, who get on because we're celebrating a beer,
fantastic,
something that brings
beverage
us together.
Yep.
And that's what I love about the brewing industry. And you just sort of see that manifest at beer events, because we've got a lot in common. We like sharing and we like talking. It's a very social industry. So that's, I think, what excites me the most.
You were saying before we got on camera, when did you start blogging? Like, when did you decide, I want to write about beer? And when did it turn into a career of writing about beer rather than just a passion project that you were like, I'm just spending way too much time at this, I need to...
I was a journalist, a trained journalist. I was working for the government, doing ministerial speeches and media releases and things like that. And as you can imagine,
hopefully
no one watches this, but none of my former colleagues. But, you know, it's not the most inspirational job. So, as a writer...
Our audience is very heavy political.
Fortunately, that gave me a big insight into some parts of the industry now, but didn't feel that my creative muscles were being exercised. And so I wanted to write. So in my own time, I would do my own little bits of writing, and I'd write about, for in-flight magazines, for example, just pitch ideas to in-flight magazines. And, if you're doing it as a sideline, as a hobby, you want to make it enjoyable, a little bit like what you guys are doing with this. You would do it regardless because you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so I was writing about things that interested me, and it was food and travel and beer.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I think beer hadn't quite broken through at that stage. And so I was a little bit uncommon in my passion for beer when everyone else was interested in wine or other things. So I was pitching stories about beer to some magazines, and some of them were picking it up because there were a couple of craft breweries. But then a lot of editors would sort of say, oh, look, we'll do a story, summer's coming on, why don't you do a story about, which beers match to the Australian cricket team, like Crown Lager is a little bit like, and this is going back a while.
Been a while since I've had a Crownie.
Well, both of the beer, but also the cricket team.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, tell us why Crown Lager is like Mark Waugh, that he's flash, whereas Steve Waugh is a little bit more like a Tui, solid and dependable. And I'm kind of going, but that's not the story. That's not the story I want to be telling about beer. You know, you can just sort of see their eyes glazing over when you're talking about beer can have flavour and things. And it was a little bit like trying to describe a sunset to someone who's colourblind. Yeah. They didn't know what you were talking about, so they couldn't picture it. So I would then go to them and sort of say, look, you know, here's a beer, and with a box of beers and some cheese and some oysters and some chocolate, and sort of say, this is what I'm talking about. And they'd go, wow, this is amazing. And then often they would write stories about me, this guy, you know, whereas I'm going, look, let me write. They're going, oh, look, we're going to do a story about you because this is really interesting. And then I've had people, you know, people would sort of start ringing and going, look, these beer and food matching things that you do. I'm going, well, I don't actually do them. So kind of I was writing, but then I was also increasingly seeing that giving people a beer, giving someone a beer and a food match, was a great way to introduce them to what I was talking about that you don't get through writing as well. And then I also met Ian Watson, who's a brewer, around when he was a sommelier. So there's all of these things happening in the very, very early days. And because I was doing it purely for passion and interest, I could go and do the things that I wanted to do. And, you know, so, I mean, this was 20 odd years ago that it first started, and there was no there were no craft beer bars in Brisbane. I had to drive 2 hours to Toowoomba to the Spotted Cow because Ian was there and made sure they had these great beers. So there was so much happening, and I could just pursue an interest, and I just happened to be the guy who was there at the right time when a lot of this took off. So you know, you can never make up for good timing and luck and those sorts of things.
Yeah. What's been the, you think, it's a two-part question, what's been the biggest positive
I'll get a four-part answer for you.
the biggest positive to come out of the amount of craft beer that's produced now, and what's been the biggest negative?
Wow, okay, that is a,
You got 100 words for each answer.
Well, I mean, look, in a lot of ways, it's been that people's view of beer has been broadened. You know, we had come through a time when craft beer was rebelling against the time that you basically had, you know, 95% of the beer in Australia was one beer marketed 16 different ways. People thought that that was all beer could be. And in a lot of ways, it was the way that people traveled internationally exposed them to the beer could be more. And they were the early brewers who came back. And you know, we've seen 20, 25 years of people realising, I mean, just look at the colours of the beer.
Like we've got three like different beers. So yeah, you've got a wheat beer, I've got a Marzen, Joel's got an IPA.
And, you know, mate, I'm not going to filter it for you. So that's one of the best things that, you know, we actually have this variety that we never had before. But at the same time, I think the excitement for the brewing industry, and because it came from such a struggle to get recognised, that there has been this view that we have to support the industry no matter what. And every brewery starting is exciting and awesome, and you know, it is just untrammeled awesomeness. And on one hand it is, but the early days when you could bootstrap your way into the brewing industry with no money, in a garage, all of those sorts of things, that's still a story that we celebrate, and it's still, and we've seen so many people come in now that the market is much more mature, that the narrative hasn't necessarily kept pace with that. And you know, it means that we've got a lot of amazing breweries, a lot of really exciting beer, but in some ways we've got too much competition. In sometimes the same places.
Because it was like, it's like that big boom industry, and now we've got our reckoning. We're just a bar now that makes our own beer, and we need that hospitality thing. It was like cafes in the 90s. You know, childcare centres in the 2000s, and breweries were the next sort of thing where people thought they could just come in, make a lot of money, and it would be easy.
And I you know, have an image of, you know, like gold rushes and things like that, where somebody finds gold and makes a front page of the paper. And, you know, it's this guy with this huge, and suddenly he's rich. And you don't see the years that he'd been digging before he found that one. And people just suddenly descend on the place thinking, I'm going to make my, and, you know, then you have one or two other stories of people that strike it rich.
Yeah.
But no one's doing stories about the, you know, 1,000 people in the same space that are
digging a hole,
lost their money. You know, their wives have packed up and left, and their friendships have fallen out. And you know, that's one of the things that doesn't get talked about is that, you know, when you read the stories about three mates who open a brewery, 5 years later you go back and sometimes they're not mates anymore, or sometimes the brewery's not still there anymore. And you know, to me, that is probably the negative. And I want every brewery to survive, but the reality is that they're not. And sometimes, you know, they're not well prepared for opening a brewery because they've been told business is booming. You know, look at all these people getting rich. Look at all these people. And it always breaks my heart. You know, and I've been doing it for long enough that I've seen a lot of, you know, people get hurt and lose, you know, money and things like that. And I don't mean to be a downer.
No.
But I think that is something that the industry needs to talk about so that the people that do still want to enter it are well prepared.
Yeah. Do you think the romantic notion of owning a brewery is well and gone now, and now it's a business decision before it is a passion decision?
And that's the thing. I hope the romance of opening a brewery never dies, because that's one of the things that makes it exciting and makes it wonderful. But that romance always needs to be balanced with the reality, you know, that, you know, if you want to buy yourself a job, sometimes just buy yourself a news agency and, you know, because that way...
I listen to enough of your podcast, I've been waiting for...
Yeah, look, mate, that's the risk. You know, I've been podcasting for 10 years, you're going to hear some of the same thing.
Oh, 100%,
It is, you know... Invest $1 million, you know, when you buy a new car, it depreciates. When you invest $1 million in brewing equipment, unless the brand grows, you're going to lose money.
It's a
really hard thing. But short answer, I hope we never lose that, you know, romance.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's an industry that doesn't need to sell itself on, because everyone, the thought of owning a brewery is you know, such a such a beacon to so many people.
Me included. I don't think I'd ever do it though now, having worked in enough breweries and seen the struggle, and plus I don't like being that office person and having to do that side of things, because it's very different roles, right?
And you know, the number of people I've spoken to over the years that just have this mental image of, particularly guys that have homebrewed, or people that have homebrewed, they love that, and then having a beer with their mates, and their mates telling them how awesome it is.
Yep.
And then, you know, you think, God, imagine if I could do this and stand at a bar and sell my beers. And they think that that's job.
That's the business.
But, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg. There's all the stuff that nobody wants to do. That, again, you don't, that doesn't look good in print, and it doesn't look good on video.
No.
And so they're the stories that aren't told. Which, you know, they probably, I think that they should be talked about a little bit more.
What's your favourite beer that you, like beer article that you've sort of read and gone, oh wow, I really love the way the person's put that? Like, who do you look up to?
Because
I read a ton of articles and I listen to a lot of podcasts. Like, I've got beer coming out my brain a million times. But,
that's an occupational hazard. Like, you never switch off. Look, I don't think I could. I couldn't do any more than summarise the things I look for. And there is so much that is restated in our industry. You know, so many things are said over and over and over again. And, you know, it's a sad thing about the media industry that clickbait, you know, the media industry has had troubles that paralleled the brewing industry in the way that, you know, it's been drastically changed. So much of what we read is just re-churned, and you know, so you're reading stuff that is just restated or reparated because you know that it generates hits. The stuff that I like is where there is original thought or an original, you know, not a hot take, but people have actually put some thought into what they're doing and what it means. Again, I realized a long time ago, it's very hard to write for the consumer, particularly if you're going to have a little business. And I could take that thought so many different ways. But so I write for the industry, because you can actually, you know, basically spend a week phoning your audience in a country of 18 million potential beer drinkers. It's very hard to reach the full market as a consumer beer writer. I write for them, and it's stuff that says, well, it doesn't matter where we were 3 years ago, it's where we're going now, so you can plan your business. And people that, you know, can really analyze and introduce new thoughts, they're the sort of things, and there's not very many of those.
Two podcasts that I used to listen to, actually three, was Brewlosophy, was yours, and and Craft Beer and Brewing, Mike Bogner, over in the US.
Yep. Like, Jamie Bogner or Mike Bogner? Jamie.
I think Mike's the other.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I think Jamie's a public,
It is Jamie. Yeah, you're right.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you there. No, you're right. I kind of skipped the first 30 seconds before, because I'd do the same with yours, actually, because it's automatic.
Yeah.
I know how long it's going to take. Get into the chat.
I'm going to have to start mixing it up a little bit.
You're going to have to work something out. Yeah, because I do that with all the podcasts.
So that means you're also skipping the ads at the end.
Do you know what else? I also listen at 1.3 times speed. And so you're talking super slow to me today.
I was going to say, do you want me to speak?
Because normally it's like, oh yeah. But what I've noticed, like for myself, especially after COVID, is a lot of the beer stuff that we get here in Australia now isn't as far apart as what it used to be from the US. Like, it's like COVID sort of squashed that weight up. If that makes sense.
In terms of the content.
Yeah, content, and also like what breweries and what beers are coming out, what styles, sort of what people are experimenting with.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know that that's a COVID thing. I think that's been happening. You know, the advent of social media has compressed that. You know, it used to be, God, 20 years ago, it was Australia.
I think
Australia
it's more on the business side of thing, like the business is going tough and stuff, because the US is obviously going through its own economic issues at the moment, and we are too. And it's very easy to see like what's happening over in the US and how they're doing things, and then can we change something here? Like, you used to be able to look at things in the US, oh, what events are they doing?
Yeah.
And try and pigeonhole it into something here, but now it's
Times have compressed. And I think social media allows us to see in real time. I think Australia's probably 6 months because of the season, you know, Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere, so you're not going to do some events in winter. So I think there's that, just the same as fashions.
Yep.
And that gives us that little bit of lag time. You know, you would have heard me say on my podcast about the Peloton effect. You know, when you think of, you know, you think of the Tour de France and you see this huge pack of cyclists and there's this kind of guys out the front and, you know, one of them swerves and then suddenly you sort of see this sort of whole thing swerve. And we used to get that advantage of see what was going on and go on. But I think it's so compressed these days that
now we're the third rider.
Yeah, and you're going into the hole. And that's a bit of a downside. But then again, we're also in a global economy, so you don't get 6 months from an economic shock in the US to have it experienced here.
No.
And that's, you know, that does make it harder.
Yep. What's your favourite beer to drink? Like, do you have a favourite beer style? Do you have a favourite sort of flavour? Or is it a...
Yeah.
Do you think you need to... Because I know I do it quite frequently. Like, I think, I've interviewed these guys. They're on tap. I should probably support them and buy their beer.
Well, there's a couple of things about that.
You know what
that.
I mean? Like, there's a lot of tangents, isn't there?
Yeah.
When you're buying a beer and...
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, my standard answer, and it, probably like you, you get asked a lot, oh, what's your favourite beer? Because And my standard answer, my next one.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's always, because that keeps
the one that's in my
hand. It's a bit of a glib answer, and it's like, all because you don't want to, and then that's very true, because that keeps the excitement of beer, you know, what's coming next. But, you know, I remember, God, it was not long after I think it might have been before we podcast, you know, my New Year's resolution, so this would have been about 2008 or 2009, when there were all of the imports, everyone's getting excited about the latest Mikkeller or whatever, and we just started seeing the breweries, and I sort of said, look, you know, all things being equal, I'm going to buy the closest version of the style that I can to me, because that's supporting all of the things that I love about the brewing industry. You know, it tends to be independent, it tends to be local, it tends to be fresh, you know, all of those things. And, you know, funnily enough, it's probably the only New Year's resolution in my life I've actually kept because it was something that was very easy to do in a way.
Yep. And you got to enjoy it.
Well, yeah, and I got to do it, and I still do that. But, you know, that's a value decision. So one of the beers that I always have in my fridge, which is another way I answer that, and it's just always in my fridge, is Japanese lager from Heads of Noosa.
Yep. Oh, cracking beer.
Because
that one,
I love
the black one.
New black one. But the Japanese lager, I keep it because I like it. You know, it's when I'm cooking dinner, you know, drink it out of the bottle. You know, for the bloke that's always advocated glass, always drink it. Anyone turns up is either going to appreciate it.
Yep.
Now that we've seen the craft beer guys go back to lager to some extent.
We've actually released one recently through Ballistic.
Okay.
Through Fortitude.
Yep.
Japanese lager.
Japanese lager.
Yeah.
I saw that again. Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, Chavez's and Japanese lagers are the ones that are coming through.
Yep.
You know, there's so much I like about that. It's local. It's become a popular trend now, which is what you, of course, and everyone's going to do it. But they were one of the first. When everyone else was going this way, they sort of said, we're going to keep our beer in bottles, we're going to make a lagers, we're going to do a light Japanese lager because that suits what we want to be doing and where we want to be doing it. And I wanted to support that. But, you know, I tell you, last night I was down the local bottle shop, in an independent bottle shop. But you see Asahi on the shelf at $21.99.
Yep.
And you see Heads of Noosa on the shelf at this bottle shop at $27.99. And, you know, it really is just sitting there going, just how much do I value these things that I've always said? And, you know, my values won out.
But,
you know, it's a hard decision. And it's standing there making those own decisions myself on a regular basis. And I, you know, I'm somebody who gets sent a lot of beer to try, but by and large, the beers that I drink, I go out and buy because otherwise you're talking about something you don't really know.
Yep.
And I give away a lot of the beer I get sent apart from the one trial.
Yeah.
Because when you're the one, you can't really comment on the industry unless you're the person standing in the bottle shop going, $6, is it worth it to me?
Yeah.
And, you know, if not, why not? And,
you
know, and that's a lot of the stuff that I comment on in the industry. So,
yeah, have a guilty pleasure beer that is from a macro brewer?
I like all beer. Like, again, if somebody gives me, you know, an Asahi, and every year, like, CUB send me a carton of Asahi or whatever.
Because
And I'll drink that quite happily.
Yeah.
But when it comes to my money, you know, that's the thing. It's put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
But again, if I had, like, I have a real soft spot for Crown Lager for a whole range of reasons.
Yep.
And, you know, because when I was growing up, it was the, you know, when we thought about premium beer, it was the beer
was
that
the pinnacle.
If you'd had a win at the races, you know, like, you know, if you wanted to show, it was what you had at your wedding and stuff like that. And then as a beer writer, it was also the one that when I found out that, shit, this is just like anything else, that I wrote a lot about it, you know, sort of going, and, you know, it changed. And it's sad that those beers have really petered out and don't really, outside of a Chinese restaurant.
I remember last time years ago, like way, way back in my hospitality career when Crown Lager first came out and I didn't even understand brewing.
You must be pretty old because according to Crown Lager, it was 1919 that it was. That was.
I aged well.
No, sorry, I'm just having a piss take.
And it was told that Crown Lager was just pulled from the top of the fermentation tank, VB the middle, and Melbourne Bitter was the bottom. And it was like,
I think that simplifies it just a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, and again, I'm not a brewer.
Yep.
And I try and make sense of, you know, and, you know, brewing is a really highly specialized. But having spoken to a lot of brewers and things like that, you know, you've got a wort stream that is functionally the same beer that they'll dial up a little bit of the bitterness or they'll sort of do this and, you know. But I did finally pin down a lovely brewer by the name of John Cousins, who was the head brewer for CUB for a while, and asked him that. And, you know, they actually let me interview him. And it basically came down to, yeah, look, it's not vastly different, but everything is high specs. So if it's at the top of the spec, if it's top of, so it's not the top of the tank or anything that.
Yeah, but because the whole tank's the same.
Basically. That's but
you always think that, when people tell you that, because there was another one, I remember a bartender telling me this when I was unknowledgeable, and I was drinking, it was one of the James Squire, I think it was the Swindler. And he was telling me,
which one was that? Was Swindler Pilsner? Because they lost me when they started naming every beer. I just go, like, I want a Pilsner. I can't remember the name. I just want to know the style.
But I just remember he saying to me, he goes, oh, do you want a slice of orange in that? And I was like, why? I wouldn't want orange in that. And he goes, oh, because the hops grow on citrus fields. That's how they get the the citrus.
And I was like, on this?
Yeah, go for it.
I was going to say, that's a bit of BS. But again,
I laugh at myself now for believing it. But I look back at it then.
But on one hand, like, it's theatre.
Yeah.
And it's marketing. It doesn't educate the consumer.
Yep.
But it's marketing. Oh, yeah. But they were also taking a leaf out of the book. And I'm sure it wasn't original when they did it. But I'm trying to think of what the American beer is. That's a Belgian wit beer.
Keith Viller. Or the Hoegaarden?
No. They model on Hoegaarden. I'm having an old man moment. Can't think of it. But they served it. And Keith Villa made sure that they had the orange and served it. And they sort of would take bags of oranges around.
Yep.
Because there was a theatre and it made people go, ooh, what's he having? And it was brilliant marketing.
Yeah.
It didn't not go with the beer. But, you know, then everyone. But then again, Coopers with the roll the bottle. You know, it's great theatre and it tells a story, it makes it stand out.
Yep.
You know, I tell people, only roll it if you like the really yeasty flavour of the beer.
Yeah,
otherwise, decant it with a little bit, because it's a double-edged sword. But, you know, it's great marketing and it creates theatre and excitement, even if it's not necessarily true.
Yeah. So you said you've never brewed. Have you ever home-brewed? Like, I know, like, have you home-brewed? Like, you get the process and that, right?
Yeah. I have, again, and it was when I, very early, you know, the 1990s, when I discovered some of the beers that were available. I found my interest in beer.
Powers Bitter?
Well, funnily enough, it wasn't Powers, because Powers was basically the same, just a version of what was already there. They just had
the
marketing.
I just remember my dad used to brew Powers Bitter out of the tins, and he was a terrible brewer, the beers tasted terrible. And I was only 15, 16 at the time, but they tasted terrible. And I thought that's what home brewing was.
Oh,
but
at 15,
and Dad pushed my career back so far because he gave me his own brewing gear.
But
and I was like, nah.
But was it the home brew? Was it 15, every beer tastes terrible?
No, I loved beer.
Okay.
I've loved beer since I was a kid.
I
loved
the bitterness.
Yeah, it was just not good. And I think back now, and it would have been diacetyl, would have been oxidized. Like, I know exactly what the problems were.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No, so I did, because you couldn't get them. And, you know, so I did Cooper's kits, and you know, the beer was fine. I just couldn't be out. Well, initially I did it because it gave you a selection, and then it was also cheaper.
Yeah.
And then I'd also do the brew for use, you know, where you would go along and brew it and get your five cartons. And stop doing that because, you know, if you've got five cartons, it's cheap.
Yeah.
You and your mates, but then you've got to drink five cartons of the same beer, and it's oxidized and things. And at the same time, the craft breweries were all opening, and so you could get that selection of beer. That my incentive, like, I'm not wired to be a brewer, and that's one of the reasons why I hold brewers in such high esteem. But it's also, and you might have picked this up on the conversation podcast that I do, that I often really drill into what is it that a brewer excites them about it, because there is something that unites a lot of brewers, because you have to like cleaning, you have to be fastidious, you can't, it's a little bit like computer code or engineering.
Yep.
If you don't connect the wires up properly, the light doesn't go on. It's just as simple as that. So you can't just do stuff, you'll electrocute yourself or something like that. And that's what fascinates me. You know, are there common threads between some of the professions or some of the interests that people have and what makes them good brewers?
Yeah.
And you know, I've got a bit of a theory about that, but it's certainly not me.
Yeah.
I don't like doing the same thing over and over and over again. That's not how I'm wired.
Yeah.
In brewing, you really have to do that.
What's your most unique beer that you've had, like, anywhere in the world that you're like, oh, I was not expecting that, like a...
Oh, okay. Well, again, it's a, I'm very lucky I get to travel for beer.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, I mean, that's a really hard question to answer in terms of unique, because these days there are so many different ones. Mm. I mean, I can remember some of the best experiences I've had, and it's having a stein at Oktoberfest, for example. It's being in a cellar in Bamberg and having a Rausch beer in this, you know, 700-800-year-old thing where all of the doors are slightly askew. But the thing I like about that is it's what I call beer in context.
Yes.
You know, we celebrate Oktoberfest here as a, you know, as a reason,
yes,
as a marketing opportunity, like Father's Day is. It's a retail opportunity, but having these things in the place,
yeah,
where there's a little bit of cultural relevance and the style was, that's what I really love.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, probably the most interesting beer experience I had was with Ian Watson, where he had a 50-odd-year-old bottle of Guinness that somebody had found in a cellar and had given to him.
Yeah, right.
And we sat around and drank it, and it was terrible. Because of the way that the flavors
developed.
But it
was a unique experience.
Yeah. It was educational. But again, I mean, they're the sort of things that...
I've got a list a mile long as well. The way I got into brewing, I was in Vietnam and I tasted a pink dragon fruit gozer at Pasture Street Brewing. And I was like, I want to learn how to make this. And it looked like a highlighter. And I've never forgotten it. I love that beer.
Yep.
And I came back to Australia, bought a home brew kit, and off I went.
Well, how long ago was that?
That would be 7-8 years ago.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, going back to the question you asked about what disappoints me is, this is just, you know, unicorn, you know, pixie dust thinking that you could make a perfect world. And my perfect beer world would be, everyone drinks beer, obviously, so there's a market for all of this, but the beers in any one place reflect that local place, because I think, you know, beer doesn't travel very well, you know.
Yeah.
So in Australia, from a business case and from a pragmatic case, I know why beers are being sent all over the country, but I think we should be traveling for beer and experiencing beer as much as possible, because, you know, like I say, wine is a postcard from where the grapes were grown, because wine travels.
Yeah.
Beer should be a reason that we travel and go to the source and go and try it and drink it in the context. And that's what I love about beer.
I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, guys, so Matt, thanks heaps, man. This has been an awesome chat so far, but I can sense that you're going to start asking me some questions, so...
Oh, man, you know me, I can't shut up.
I know,
I've had a lot of fun, thank you.
Yeah, that's cool, no worries. Well, we're going to get in and have another interview, because I reckon that'll be great.